Ladies and gents, welcome back to the Tyson Popplestone Show. Always good to have you here. Thanks for stopping by. Today in the show, we are joined by Australian performance coach by the name of Mark Dobbo Dobson. Mark has worked with the who's who in the world of sport and business for the last 25 plus years. Now, for those of you who have heard him here before, I first met him back in 2004 at a talk that I heard him do and was mind blown by what he had to say, and naturally sort of started to pivot towards his message, and I've learned so much from Mark over the years. He's always a great guy to talk to about so many factors around mindset, performance, breakthrough, just strategy for life is a really good way to cover him with an umbrella term. Today was no exception. So with that said, welcome to the show, Mr. Mark Dobson.
So what are you going to tell us, tough guys? My usual, zero, nothing.
But I don't know if you know Chris Williamson, the Modern Wisdom podcast host.
No.
He's got a massive podcast now. And he said he got to about 50 episodes in and he was just doing interviews with like quite well-known guests. And this is 5 years ago. And he goes, it just blew my mind how few downloads they were getting. So I don't know what changed between whatever he was doing then and what he's doing now. But his podcast has just skyrocketed.
Mm.
But I often think as well, like, I don't want to underestimate all the groundwork that I'm sort of putting in now, because eventually, say, for example, someone tunes in 3 years, like this podcast with me and you is naturally still available. So they might scroll back and I can imagine that makes a big impact. But yeah, I really don't know, Dobbo. I'm trying to get my head around the whole, despite being in it for so long, it feels like a relatively new scene because it seems to be constantly changing. And I don't know. I just love doing it.
Even with my career, and I've spoken to a few friends about this in different careers, we tend to agree that half the battle is just staying in the game. Like I'm 50 now and I've been doing this since I did my first speaking gig when I was 17. So, you know, other people just give up. And I heard in Arnold Schwarzenegger's new book, The Useful, he says, failure never killed a dream, but quitting did. And my dad makes fun of me being an overnight success because he knows it's not an overnight success. You know, you get people that call you and they saw you on stage 4 years ago and they ask you, can you come and do a presentation? Now, there's other people that have to say, oh, no, I've got a full-time job now. I can't. So I agree there is this longevity. And I think if you crush it on, say, Australian Idol, you are famous fast, but you disappear fast. And so you need to do the groundwork. But a big one is just whether or not you can pay the bills in the meantime or on the journey.
Yeah. I had an old mate or an old mentor. He's about 75. He worked at our church as a pastor and he had a quote. He said, that which goes hot easily often goes cold easily.
Mm.
And it's so true. And it's amazing as well because you've got to be careful. You'll see someone who's skyrocketing in whatever scene it is. Maybe for me it's comedy. Maybe it's the world of podcasts.
Mm.
And you go, must be nice. But then all of a sudden you go, oh, well, Chris Williamson, for example, he's done 800 episodes over a 5-year period, which works out to be about 2.5 episodes a week for 5 years.
Yeah. And
good luck maintaining that.
That's right. And you've got to be a true outlier. And usually you're out of balance. Something is not happening. And I think for me, when my early part of my career, I was single for so long without any financial or family commitments that I could just keep persisting. I also think when I see speakers particularly just skyrocket, they're usually on a hot thread that represents the present flavor. So my agent will say, oh, Dobbo, can you do something on diversity or can you do something on AI? And I'm like, I don't want to. They're not my areas. And they'll often respond with that I think you can actually help a lot because both of these require change, embracing fears, et cetera. And I can do that, but people really just want, give me 45 minutes on what AI is going to do to change my job or my life or, you know, that clap. And so those people will crush it. And I've heard so many speakers that they'll make 600K in like an 18-month period. Everybody's got them. And then they're just gone. They just cannot get back in because they're so heavily branded with that identity and that topic.
It was interesting. I remember starting to go down, like dipping my toes in the water. Like I was doing quite a lot of school speaking and I thought that I knew I wanted to be involved in communication in some capacity. And for me, I just thought it was that world of mindset. That was something that I sort of clicked with. That was obviously how we first met years ago now. But I got connected with an agency briefly here in Melbourne, and they said, oh, did you want to? No, I submitted a couple of keynote ideas that I'd been doing at schools, and they were like, look, it's probably, we're not interested in those. And the guy said, oh, would you be interested in speaking about Gen Z or whatever it was? Mm. And he goes, oh, you might get up to 10 grand a talk. And I was like, oh, I just remember being on the phone and being like, it's one of those situations where I just genuinely, I don't give a shit about 10 grand if it means I have to talk about Gen Z for an hour. I'm the wrong man for the job. Yeah. I think there's better people out there. It's an interesting scene for that reason, because I've noticed there's like a little bit of that going on. You've obviously got some swag in there. You can put your foot down and say, oh, it's not really my strong point. I've got my key areas. But I guess as a new kid on the block, they were maybe expecting me to say, like 10 grand, that sounds amazing. I'll talk about whatever you need me to for 10 grand.
Yeah.
But I don't know. There's something in me that just squirms when it thinks about having to speak in front of an audience about a subject I just could not give a shit about.
Yeah, it's certainly changed a bit like that for me. Like, I get asked to speak for, say, cigarette companies or gambling companies. And when I was a kid, I was in no way. Like, I was very righteous about that stuff. And now I'm probably one of the few speakers. Like, a lot of speakers continue to say no, and my agent contacts me because they know I'm a maybe. And I know there's some people really are judging me harshly for that, but I find it's easy to be black and white. It's harder to be gray. And to go in those environments, to take a brief and work out, could I contribute that? Could I solve that problem inside my own values? And the way I see it now is that I learned that if I'm working for, say, you know, a chocolate company or an airline, or it doesn't matter. There's all just people, and they're just doing their best in life. And if I can make that individual a little happier, they're going to go home and they'll be a little bit nicer to their partner and their kids, and they're a bit lighter. Then that has a ripple effect. And I really now just see it that I'm doing my best to talk to the people in that room, and that company gives us the opportunity to have the conversation. So I meet the needs of the brief, but I'm very open. I'll say to people, I really couldn't give a crap about what you do. I don't care about chocolate or airlines or cigarettes or anything. I'll help you because that's the game we're playing. It's also when I've helped people win Olympic medals or sing on Australian Idol. Yeah, it's just the medium that we've got to have a human experience. And we can't get too invested in this thing, even though we have to be invested to get an outcome. We also got to realize we're just humans. Mm. And so that's challenging. And as it turns out, I still haven't been hired by a cigarette company because I think that perhaps I'm still too values driven, and they go, oh, maybe not. Or the other thing is, a lot of the presenters that I watch, they don't have a lot of strong content. They've got a strong story and they can't really move the needle. Most of the work I get, kind of gone off tangent a bit here, but most of the work I get is from companies that they actually have a problem and they're trying to get a very specific outcome. They're trying to move the needle in a tangible way. So if they want a famous story, someone climbed Everest and they lost their leg on their way or something, I'm just not that guy. So it's been interesting to your point about, agent calls you and says, could you do this topic? It's fine. I find now I'm much better at knowing what I don't do and I can't do well, but also being less judgmental about who's hiring me for my contribution. It's been interesting and challenging. And I'm not even sure if I'm right. I might change my mind later and think that was a mistake. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, when you take a step back and look at a corporation for what it actually is, just like a massive group of people, it does make it easy to present to whoever it is you're presenting to. Because, yeah, I find that difficult. Like, if you go on to speak to a corporation and you see the stickers on their window, I go, I'm not interested in anyone here. But the truth is, I'm probably interested in everyone there.
Yeah.
But it's just the bullshit that, like, the facade of, hey, look, we're an organization and we're professional and we care about these things and we value this. And it's like, well, I know at home you're not, very few of you are actually living up to the standards that you say that your business lives up to. Mm. And it's just, It's, I don't know, it's the same as when I put on a suit when I go out. I'm like, oh, I'm an adult and I'm playing dress-ups. I don't wear, what am I doing? Mm. Like, it's a, that's not me. I don't like suits. I don't like the feel of suits, but it's weird when I go into a corporate setting now after a few years of not being in a corporate setting. You see a room full of adults wearing suits,
yeah,
saying the right things, starting the meetings in the right way. You go, well, okay, we're playing pretend, I think. Like, I don't know.
Well, what it is, every group of people has a culture that they've decided and a group of behaviors that they've decided to embrace, even though they're soulless. And it was interesting when I did a talk years ago, many, many years ago now, and I presented with a suit on and a tie. And the guy that brought me in afterwards said, Dubbo, lose the tie. It's just not you. And it was great advice. At first, I was a bit embarrassed or I didn't really understand. And then over time, I just realized, yeah, I actually, the tie's not me. And then I found my, I don't know, urban style of what I wear when I go into corporate. So I'm generally a pair of jeans and a jacket of some sort. But I also find that sometimes I can be I scare them a little bit when I go in because I'm so candid and I'm so honest. I'm not rude. It's more like they can't predict me. They can't work out what I'll do, where everything else around them is predictable.
Yeah.
Where I may not embrace a particular line of thought. And it's not like I'm radical. I'll just ask a different question. Say, like, do we really need to have muffins? Could we just, we're all going to go down and get a coffee anyway. So should we just go get a coffee? Like, or we're all going to scroll exactly Facebook anyway. Should we just scroll for a second and take a 5-minute scroll break? They don't know how to respond to that. It's too honest.
I remember, I've said this to you before, but I remember once at our high school, big old Lancey, bloke was sitting in the middle row and was talking in the middle of your set. I've been doing comedy for a while. In the middle of your talk, and you stopped and said, "Mate, if you don't want to be here, fuck off." And everyone in the room. Well, I mean, you were back at our school 4 more times, so it obviously wasn't that big of an impact. But I remember that people were shocked because they're not used to. I feel, yeah, I know what you mean. I can see how you've got you seem like you've got a very direct, honest approach to communication, which I really like. Like, no one has to guess what Dobbo's feeling about them. Yeah. Like, if you don't like something, you'll call me out on it. If you do like something, you'll tell me about it. If you think you can see something I can correct, you'll guide me on it. And I feel like it's difficult to be like that. Like, sometimes I'll be sitting in a conversation where or a situation where I might completely disagree with someone. I'm sure you do this as well. I'll disagree with someone. I won't like the way someone's handling a situation. And rather than actually offering any feedback, I'll second guess myself. And I don't know, maybe sometimes it's a skill, but maybe sometimes it's a weakness where I think I could actually alleviate an awkwardness or a tension in a situation by just calling it out rather than letting it linger. I feel like you'd be a difficult man to walk over the top of because people know they're not going to get away with bullshit if they're trying to run it your way.
You're probably right. It's an interesting one because say an audience member and you're hearing that about me being candid and telling you what I think, it sounds like it's aggressive when it's actually not. I've got a big heart and I care about people. So I don't say that unless it's helpful to the collective or it's not about a brashness. I think people don't understand that. They take a candidate at face value. Is it he's going to tell me whatever he thinks? What's he thinking now? Just tell. And everybody's always having mini judgments and all the time. And they've got so many things they just don't say. I will, if it's helpful to the outcome, then I'll say it. And I think there's that famous example, which we've probably spoken about on the show before, that where Tansel, who was my memory friend in a discussion group, we're all setting our goals and he had made quite clear his goals. And I said, the problem is, Tansel, that you wear a jacket that doesn't fit you and your promo photo, you look like a terrorist. And and everybody tried to stop me from saying that. Oh, Dobbo, I don't think that's what you mean. But I knew exactly what he was trying to achieve. And they were the two obstacles. So he didn't take any offense because that was directly aligned with what he was saying, what he was trying to achieve. Now, if I just said that to him at a party one day, that's really rude. And so I think you can be very candid if you're very clear on what that person or that group is trying to achieve, and then you have value. Outside of that, I'll just hold my tongue because there's no value in it. Like, what do I care? Like, my dad's a funny one. He'll always get annoyed at his brother for having a beard. Even me, he gets annoyed. Ah, what? And I said, Dad's got nothing to do with you. He goes, oh, but it looks better the other way. And I was like, it doesn't matter what you think, Dad. Like, you should shut up about that because it's got nothing to do with you. Like, I just pointed out all his flaws. He's like, ah. So there's this time where it's just a judgment and it's based on trying to create everybody to fit your worldview. And there's a time when you hear, what are you trying to achieve? And let me contribute to that. And I feel like people sometimes when they hear candid, they don't hear warmth.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I don't know if you've seen any of the news stories around Arj Barker in the Melbourne Comedy Festival the last few weeks.
I saw the headlines.
Asking the lady to leave the room with a crying baby. And there's all this discussion, oh, should the lady with the crying baby be allowed at comedy? And I'm like, my answer is 100%. I don't know what the lady was thinking. Like, what a wild decision to even consider taking an infant to a comedy show. Like, Arj is, in my opinion, and everyone I know who's been to a comedy show, like, you can play the game of, oh, the poor lady. But if you're at that comedy room, you're thinking, oh, shut the fuck up.
Every single
like, person. It'd be like a baby going to the movies. I'm not interested in your baby being there. And I would never take my baby because I'm honestly, like, I'll sit at home and watch comedy and I'm tempted to put my own baby outside just because I don't want it to interrupt my own comedy experience. So put me in a room with 500 people with your dumb crying baby and, yeah, watch me respond. But, yeah, it is funny. You're right. There's such a different approach depending on what it is you're trying to get out of a situation. Like, I don't know his name. I can't remember the memory guy.
Oh, Tanzel.
Tanzel. Yeah, I don't know. You sound like you had a good relationship with Tanzel, as you say. So to call him out is actually a positive step. But for me to go to some random person and say that, you just got to, I don't know, maybe what you have is just that ability to be able to recognize what the situation calls for. You've got enough social skills to stop yourself when you're at a party, but you've got enough confidence to call it out when it's going to be a benefit to the person.
Yeah, I think I do. I think it's a lot of listening. Like, I didn't know we would talk about this particularly. So sometimes I get, I'm not sure if it's self-conscious, but it's sometimes it's tricky to talk about these things about yourself without it sounding egotistical. But if I observe myself, I see some people that they can just remember a name. Like my mate Dan, any bottle of wine we've ever had, he can remember the name of the bottle and probably how much it was. And he remembers every phone number I've ever had. And he just remembers that. But I had an athlete contact me. He's going into this Olympics and was struggling with sleep at a trial just recently. And his coach said, oh, maybe contact someone at the AIS and see what they can say about sleep. And he just texted me and I said, no, mate, it's easier than that. And I just gave him a couple of strategies around it. And I said, but read the first chapter of Costa Zoo's book because it's a really interesting story about that. Now, I read Costa Zoo's book maybe 15 or 20 years ago, whenever it was first out. And I remember that one chapter. And I also probably know it's John chapter 6 and 7 of that book. How the hell? I just remember these concepts when it comes to people. And then I think I've matured noticing what a feeling in my body means. So sometimes somebody will really irritate me and that irritation is we have a different view on the world. Sometimes they're irritating me because I feel somewhere different in the body. I'm like, oh, no, they're lying. There's another time I have an irritation in my body or a sensation and it means that I need to be brave and say something. So I feel like it's an emotional intelligence, but it doesn't mean you're right because I've seen other leaders tell me that, oh, I operate on intuition. And I'm like, no, you don't. You operate on completely flippant, oh, you're all over the place. I know I've developed a skill there, but I also think that I never take it for granted when I'm in front of an audience. If I have to make a call on or with a client and I have to say something brave and challenging, I'm not immune to the adrenaline and the fear and the sick in the stomach. What are they going to say? Losing sleep over it for a couple of days. Did it go down well? I still have all those emotions. But if I don't do it, then I probably don't have any texture in life. Probably just too bland.
Yeah. People seem very happy to just go along, especially here in Australia. One thing I've noticed since spending some time in the States is Australia seems very happy to operate in status quo to a large degree. Like the tall poppy syndrome 100%. Might be an example of this. When someone stands out, we try and cut them down. And it's maybe the one part of Australia's culture that I'm really, really not a fan of, though I fall into it at times, especially if I don't like the person we're cheering for.
Yeah.
But it's a side effect of that seems that a lot of the time we don't call out bad behavior. Or that's the wrong expression, because sometimes we don't have the challenging conversations. We won't speak to someone about the behaviors that we don't like or that we should. Mm. This, as I say this, I'm double guessing myself, because I know I've got personal relationships where I feel this isn't true. Like I'll call out my best mates if I disagree with something. They'll do the same for me. My wife is a genius at it. she'll call out all the things I can improve, but also sprinkle like a little bit of encouragement on top to make sure I really absorb it well. But I think it seems to me that the reason, like, that brazen approach or that bold approach to calling stuff out is often seen as a rudeness or an egotistical thing is because it just doesn't really happen here.
Yeah,
and I don't know why that is. Whereas in the States, there seems to be these are massive stereotypes, but there seems to be, to my first point, like a celebration of big wins, but also a very bold approach to calling out a lot of bullshit. My brother-in-law would disagree. He lives in a part of Oregon where he thinks it's the opposite. There's too much nicety and there's too much, even if I completely disagree with everything you're saying, I'm going to smile and just accept it because that's you. I don't know.
Yeah.
But do you know what I'm trying to say? Yeah. Like between the two countries, there seems to be a stereotype, and the stereotype is that Australians are status quo who don't like seeing standouts, and Americans are like, hey, let's celebrate this crazy man gone for this big thing.
Yeah, I think America is a capitalist country and Australia is a socialist company that looks capitalist. And so you get this, let's all be pretty similar here, guys. Let's all be pretty similar. And like I spent a lot of time in the States, like 10 years in the States. And over there, you'd be out having drinks with a bunch of people and somebody would get up to leave and say, oh, why are you going? Come on, have another drink. And they'd tell you why. Oh, no, I've got national championships in the morning. You know, like they'd say that thing that in Australia, you just say, oh, no, I got to go. I just want to get off. You wouldn't say what you were working on and what you did. And in America, tends to celebrate these achievements, if you like, and everyone's leaning into them. I think, you know, you're right about the generalizations, but generally, I think what I try to bring is what I call putting paint on the fence. So years ago, I had a small group of school teachers that I was coaching. The school had hired me to advise them every 2 months or so to help them with their goals so that they could then know how to help the kids with their own goals. And there's a woman that came to the sessions, and in the first session, she said, I really want to paint. I've got a white picket fence out the front. It needs to be painted. I want to paint it. So great. So we set that as a target between now and the next session. We come in and she hasn't painted it. Oh, what's going on? She goes, well, I had to research what kind of paint, and I had to do some sanding on it, and then the grass was long, so we had to cut that back. And so then next quarter and then 2 months later, she says, she still hasn't painted it. She goes, well, I had to research this, and then because it was wet, it didn't work. And this went on for a whole year. Now, she at no point put any paint on the fence. She did every other activity. If she had have got the can of paint and thrown it at the fence, it would have been more effective than what she'd done. And I find when I go into an environment that there's all this busy work, all this punching underwater, missing everything, everybody's stressed and strained and another meeting about that, and they think that performance is about escalating all the activity, and it's actually not about escalating. It's usually about refining it and doing less. And now I feel like my role is to help people actually get that traction, actually get the paint on the fence. All these ideas, could I turn them into something? And there's a lot of myths that you've got to take somebody through. One is the escalation. So let's say we want to release a newsletter, or we want to have a podcast, or you want to, you know, set up a new company. There's this sense that, right, let's have a meeting, get everybody in here. I need my IT guy and I need my designer, and it actually doesn't need this escalation of involvement. there's a few things that you need to do as an individual or a small department. And the other thing is that people think that performance requires more effort and it's actually less. Like you as a running coach would know that there are some people when you watch them run, they're just burning up so much energy in an inefficient way, where the person that's really running beautifully, that there is no wasted effort. Performance is not about more effort. It's about no wasted effort. Everything has a return on the energy. And so I think a lot of my cadness, as you said, or my, you know, don't walk over the top of me. If we're going for a target, I tend to be the person that is the constant on the path to getting there. And if you stray off, I'm just going to call you back into line. And if I get too much feedback or people don't like that, then I'll always come back to the outcome and say, oh, do we actually want this outcome? Like, and if they say, no, I don't, I'm like, oh, okay, that's fine. And I heard a comedian say it beautifully the other day. He said, people get jealous of what you've achieved. They don't get jealous of what it took to get there.
Yeah.
And so I have to verify, I'll check, do we want to hit that commercial target, or do we want that podcast live, or do we really want that? They say, yes. Well, it takes these activities. You're not doing those activities. Are you sure you still want it? And they were, and then a story comes out, and sooner or later, there's a breaking point where you have to choose, which one do you want, the method you've been using for a long time or the outcome? And
yeah,
and I've got to verify how hungry somebody's after the outcome.
Yeah. There's a guy I really like. Do you know Rick Rubin, the music producer?
No.
Such an interesting guy, man. I reckon he's written a book called The Creative Act. So Rick Rubin, I probably heard of him about 2 years ago, just through a friend of mine who's involved in the music production world. And he showed me a video of this guy, and immediately I took to him. And it was partly because he looks like a full-blown hippie. Like, he never has shoes on, got the long hair. He looks a bit ratty. He's a multi-millionaire. Like, he's worked with Kanye and Jay-Z and Beyonce and Red Hot Chili Peppers and the who's who of the music industry. And I just, as a combination of the way he looked, but also the way he spoke, I went down this rabbit hole of just listening to so many interviews. A great introduction is probably like on Lex Friedman's podcast. They sat down for a couple of hours and they just spoke about music and the process. And one thing they keep coming back to was this idea that his role as a music producer is often not to add anything to the music, but to remove the things that he doesn't think should be there. He says he's not a I might be butchering this, but he says he's not a professional producer. He's a professional. He's a reducer. Mm. He spends his whole music career just reducing like the excess in songs and just bringing it down to its bare minimum, essentially, like taking away no more than what should be taken away, but getting rid of everything that shouldn't be there. And his whole mindset around just that process of reducing music's really interesting, from the way he works with the artists to the way he listens to the music to the honestly, everything he says about the creative process is incredible. It's one of the best books that I actually listened to it, but it's one of the best books that I've ever listened to. It seems like a coffee table book that it'd just be good just to go back to, flip open a page and see what he says about the writing process or whatever. Yeah. Because he's got this unique ability to be able to put words to things that, you know, I think a lot of us realize that we think, but we don't know really how to vocalize. And that seems true with everything. You said before, like, the example that works for me is the running example. I know exactly what you mean. When you say to someone, run fast, a lot of the time that advice is just combined with try harder. And yeah, sure, that is true to an extent, but if you're trying harder with ineffective technique, then the results are not going to be any more impressive. In fact, chances are you'll just get tired more quickly.
Yeah.
And there's a guy that I do a lot of online yoga, this guy, Travis Elliott. He often says throughout the class, he goes, oh, if you're trying hard, stop it. It's time to try easy. And I know exactly what he means, because the idea of trying easy, it's like, hey, release that stress that comes with wanting to improve. And just relax, enjoy the process. I find that so enjoyable with any endeavor that I do. Like, if I'm working on a new joke or working on a new fitness routine, I'll often be like, oh, like, I just want this to be refined and perfect. And I'll get stressed in the process because I'm like, it's not where I want it to be. But that try easy approach is just the understanding that, like, what in your life ever, the first or second time you've tried to do it is impressive. The right. answer is like next to nothing. Like, I think the answer is actually nothing. And so the idea of trying easy just removes so much stress from the endeavor. Because the truth is, like, we're all stuck on this road towards Like the person we are now is going to be different to the person we are in 15 years, for better or for worse. And so you may as well just enjoy that process, like have some clarity on where you're trying to get to, but then enjoy the journey, because it's going to be a pretty miserable next 15 years if you, you know, you don't adopt that try easy and you just struggle your way through it. Sounds like a really depressing way to live.
I love that term. I'll follow up that book, because I am curious about that myself, because I definitely found that most of my work is noticing what is irrelevant and busy work. The try easy is great language, because I'm often trying to articulate that to people and often trying to embrace that myself, because sometimes a task requires you to apply yourself to it. And school gave us this framework that said, for you to be successful, it should take a lot of time. It should be unenjoyable. At the end of it, you should be exhausted. And you probably found the whole process hard and had to go again. And if a clear example would be if you did your homework and you came out and you said, "Mum, got it done in 5 minutes, absolutely loved it, smashed it, got so much energy." Her response is, "Get back in there and continue." Where the reality is, with performance, there is a return on effort, and sometimes it's a delayed return, but you're doing the right activity. And I've got a few new ventures going on where I have to learn some skills around and processes. So my work has taken me, I've made a lot of people rich, the crazy rich. And I didn't have a stake in those businesses. So now my model is, well, if I'm going to be involved with helping somebody, I take an equity position or a bonus position. And that's meant sometimes that I've had to learn, for example, how software, the sales process for software works, which is different, say, to a consulting process. And it's sometimes quite uncomfortable and quite difficult. And I'm doing the hard trying until I've seen the whole thing. And now I look at it, now that I've learnt it, I can actually refine it better than my mentor or whoever was guiding me on it, because I realised they were making a lot of mistakes. And I also have found that by having young kids particularly and a couple of new ventures going on in my diary packed, I was always just running so hard that I didn't have a minute between things. And as a result, there wasn't the opportunity to observe and ponder what is the smartest way. And years ago, I helped somebody in the States, and this actually is quite universal for anybody that gets promoted. The philosophy of working hard and having a lot on, it just permeates every part of life. And when people get promoted, they often just think, I now have to work harder, work longer hours, apply myself more, take on more, and they don't work out what they have to not do. And so if you get promoted, you should also create a list of, I no longer do these activities. But for him, I couldn't articulate that then. So that I just got a big sticker and put it on the front of his computer and said, are you being an effing idiot right now? And that was for him to ask the question. When you start the computer and you're emailing that, is that really what you should be doing? Yeah. And so I found, like, just being so crazy busy the last 18 months, I wasn't taking the time to observe and then work out what the most potent activity is. And that observation time is actually critical to performance. The rest between reps is critical to performance. You know, the rest between runs is critical. But we just fill it. And I was making the mistake of filling it. Well, also life asked me to with young kids. I didn't have a lot of choice.
Well, yeah, it's funny you say that, because I feel like I'm in that right now. My life is, how old are your kids again?
Well, they're young. Jack's about to turn 3 and Holly's about to turn 5.
Yeah. So we're in a fairly similar age. I've got a 3.5-year-old, Charlie, yep. And I've got a 1.5-year-old, Ollie. And it is wild. I want to be a good dad. Like one of my roles or one of my big focuses is to make sure that, or do my best to make sure that when my boys are 25, they look back and go, man, dad was a legend. Like how good was it having dad around? But naturally, as a result of that, especially working from home, it means that a lot of the time, the times that I would like just to go and do some of that clear head work or some of that, I just need an hour to myself. I just want to go and clear my head. I'm playing dinosaurs with a boy who's yelling at me because I haven't understood the concept of his game because he hasn't got the fucking words to explain it. Yeah. And I'm sitting there just going like, it's interesting. I don't think I was it's not that I wasn't warned. It's just that I don't think I heed the advice because I didn't really understand what I was stepping into. I love being a dad. Mm. Don't get me wrong. Love it. Amazing.
I'm not sure
but
I do.
But it is one of the.
I'm not sure I do. I think everybody says that, and I don't like being a dad. I love my kids. I love them. I would take a bullet for them, but I can't play magnetiles anymore with them. Like, I prefer to take a bullet. It's easier because at least I can be in my masculine, right? I can go out there. Someone's trying to bang on the door. I'll go beat them up with a baseball bat. Fine.
And you'll be remembered as a hero forever.
Exactly right. But excuse me, just coughing away here without the mute button on. But I find it really hard. But I often hear other dads say, oh, I love being a dad. And then what runs through my head first is, are you an involved dad? Or are you leave early, come home, do cuddles and play and tuck them into bed and then play golf on Saturday morning and don't actually have a lot of contact hours? I'm heavily involved. And I find it so hard. I find it so unbelievably hard. I have a joke where I often say, and I think people take this the wrong way, but my kids will yell at me about the way I cut their toast or something, or it's not done right, or that's not the right plate. And I have to remind them that I'm quite important at work and people respect me. And these little kids going berserk at me about something. And I find that really difficult because between 0 and 6, they're not rational. And I find that really, really hard. And I've gone and studied this a lot. I've got a lot of clients that I advise, but they've got kids older than me. And as soon as I get on a call, if anybody's late, I'm like, great, I want some dad advice. And I'm super receptive to this. And I openly try to talk about how difficult it is because it's not that I don't love them and it's not that I wouldn't do it again, but I'm in total struggle town being asked to be something that I'm not. And I also agree with working from home. I don't like that I'm home, but I'm not mentally there, or I have to keep apologizing, or they see me at home, but I'm not available to them. So then they can take that as a rejection. And I'm constantly trying to grapple with how to handle that. I've definitely gotten better at finally getting up at about 5 or 5:30 now, which is not something I ever thought I would do in my life. But I'll exercise and then do some work before the kids get up, and I feel like I'm in charge of my life and I'm ready. That's been super helpful. However, that has not been easy. Like Dad said, oh, the other day, how long have you been doing that for? And I said, well, Dad, I've been trying to do it for about 3 years. And it's not that I was failing. There's a lot of learning to happen. I remember going through Instagram for hours just looking at all these videos, but I was looking at exercise videos, trying to work out what, if I finally get the opportunity to do this, how should I do it? And I was practicing, like I've just had a few injuries. I've been recovering and then I experimented with working in the exercise in the evening and experimented with getting up at 6:30. That wasn't early enough. And then I tried, so many things and I finally found a mojo and it's liberating me. But also Holly's just about to turn 5. And statistically, we know that the saddest you'll be in your life is the first 5 years after having children because it's the most selfless period. And so I could look like, oh, I finally worked it out. But I don't think so. I think my kid can finally wipe her own bum. And that's, and other things like she can just be a little bit more rational. She can put her clothes on and she can just cut you this slack. That's really creating some space for me.
Yeah. That's well said. I didn't know that about the stats for the first 5 years of your life. That's nice to know because I've definitely caught myself going, look, I would say that it's definitely not a depression at all. Like it's not a depression, but it's just like
it's a struggle
oh
though.
My God.
Deep struggle.
Like what is again? Like what? I'm just. It's funny. Jessie will come home sometimes, and there'll just be toilet paper all over the floor. And she goes, "What's happened here?" I go, "Oh, it's just that's me paying rent. Like they're allowed to do that because I just want to sit on the couch and drink a coffee and not and not playing whatever it is they're playing for 5 minutes." It's interesting how rarely it gets spoken about. I would say it's probably a bad example because of the fact I wouldn't take a bullet for running, but. Running a lot of the time is a very painful endeavor. Like it's more commitment. I don't enjoy more of the runs than I do enjoy. You obviously have to put in the hard work before you see a whole heap of results. But I guess while you're out there, you get your own peace and quiet, you get your own thinking time. But Jessie often says to me, she's like, I just don't get why you enjoy being a runner. I'm like, I don't know, like it's rewarding in a strange way. And that's when I say I love being a dad, I think I'm referring to it in the sense of I love being a dad like I love being a runner. There's a lot of sacrifice. There's a lot of frustration, a lot of pain, a lot of commitment before you see any results. Like if I have to tell my kid one more time to say please, you know, it just seems like a lot of the hard work goes towards nothing. But I keep hearing from parents who are further down the road than us who will say, no, just, hey, I know it's hard. But when they're 25, if you stay strong with the values that you're trying to enforce in them, you're doing it in a way that they feel loved and encouraged, you're going to look back and go, oh, thank God. And one thing that parents at that stage also say when I tell them, like, you've got kids between 0 and 5, they go, oh, you're in it.
Yeah,
they do. And so it is this thing that people recognize. But it's funny when you're in it, you're like, oh, what have I done? Like, this is my life forever now. It just feels as though you've got yourself this weird prison sentence where all you are is a slave to these kids with endless needs, which is obviously part of the role. But man, I tell you, mum used to always say, never have kids to make a marriage stronger. Oh. And now I get it. I get it. Because as strong as my marriage is with my wife and as much as we love each other, I tell you, just that constant stress of like the
fatigue. It's just this fatigue and you're both struggling. And what I found is that as a human, you want to use all of your intellect and all of your ability, and running lets you do that. But when you're sitting playing blocks, you're not using your intellect and your ability. So you can do it for a while, but you can't sustain it. And I can also run, you know, I could use my intellect and my ability, but at some point there's a nourishment that's missing, and so my family does that. So getting this balance is how can I have some family nourishment and live that? It's like apple pie. You can love apple pie, but you can't have it every night for dinner. You go mad. And so that there's that tension, and it's helpful to know that, because you can't expect to live on bread alone. You can't expect to live on the engagement with your children alone. Now, maybe there's some outliers that can, but generally that's not the case. The other thing that I've noticed and I learned, which is super helpful, was that the children alternate between play and connection. And they will play with a toy independently. And often you don't actually have to play with them. You've just got to start them playing with it. And then once they enter into this play, they finish playing and then they look for connection. They literally run back to you. And if the TV's been on, which we rarely, rarely watch TV because it just sends them nuts. But if we were to put TV on, and there's some shows we know that they laugh and they engage with it, they don't sit mindlessly, we'll let them, like Bluey, for example, they really respond well to. And there's a Mickey Mouse Club one where they sort of yell the numbers back. It's beautiful. But when you can turn it off, they often then don't just come to dinner or do the next thing because they need to move to connection again. Excuse me. I feel like this happened last time I was on your show. They have to move to connection again. And it has been helpful to just know that that's the cycle. And when they come back for connection, if they get it, then they will leave again. Now, that's not practical when I've been trying to do something in the house, especially for power tools or something. I want to build something. I like making stuff. But just I've really been trying to work out how does it actually work so that I can work out what is my responsibility and when is it it's just stuffed. It's just the nature of the crisis. It's just all overwhelming. And I do like to talk about it. And I've got a few clients that just laugh at how open I am about it, but they also say how refreshing it is. And I think it's probably a good example of how we candid, how we started. I'm just saying what I do feel and what is true, because I don't think it's healthy to perpetuate a lie for people. Now, there's other people that do enjoy being a dad and love it. There are times I love it, but I don't love it in the volume that I'm asked to do it. And then I feel bad because I can see it's impacting the kids in an unhealthy way. And then I beat myself up about that and I want to do it better, but I haven't found a better strategy. And so it continues again. Like it's quite brutal. And it is really difficult on marriages too, that because we think that our partner is somehow immune to the challenge, but they've similarly got the same challenge where they're bored as well. There's a limit to how much kid stuff they can do.
Yeah. Yeah. Jesse said to me the other night, like my favorite thing to do at the end of the day is to, I want my own space, or just when the kids are in bed, let's hang out, Jesse. Well, let's do that. Or I'll go and do comedy, and I get a couple of hours each way in the car. And it's just nice to clear my head. But it is funny. Jesse and I, we refuel in very different ways. I just want to be alone and just leave me alone. And like, let's watch a show or chill or whatever. Like, let's just be quiet because I had to listen to this just noise all day. Whereas Jessie's the opposite. She's like, oh, just now I feel like I need some adult time. I want to go and spend time with adults and chat and catch up. And that's like another dynamic. Like she's probably, the way she's recharged is probably a little more extroverted than what I am. And it is one of the most in-depth self-reflections you're ever forced to take is, okay, like why did I snap like that? Why do I think that? I don't know what your parenting style is like with you and your wife, but my wife, she'll often laugh. Like she'd be the first to tell you she likes the way I am as a dad. She's mostly encouraging. But the one thing that she'd critique me on is I'm impatient. And I think I'm impatient to the extent that she's possibly the most, sometimes to her own detriment. Like she's so incredibly patient that I feel sometimes the kids get away with more than they should. And I go, mate, like I would love it to be the 1970s right now because this could be well and truly sorted with a smack.
I totally agree. I just want to go home with a pipe, read the paper, and then someone else.
I could smack my kid and then just go and get shit-faced at the pub and wake up tomorrow and try again. Yeah. But now, I don't know. Yeah, it's
we have that
my
dynamic. Mum said to me. We have that dynamic.
Sorry, go on.
No, exactly on that patience. But I find my wife is incredibly patient with the children, but with the things that she wants and with me, there is no patience.
Yeah.
So typically the feminine, if we can even talk about that stuff anymore, the masculine feminine, because that's a great conversation about how in a community, once we're uncomfortable with something like we were in the 70s, we're uncomfortable with structure and the big banks and wearing a suit, that we threw it all out and just wore hippie clothes. We're going through another revolution right now where we're throwing out culture and any kind of parameter in the process. We're left with nothing, like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But the feminine as purist is actually lacks patience, and the masculine has the ability for patience. You know, in the extreme, I don't really go this like caveman version, but it's an easy way to explain it. It's like, you know, sitting, hunting, waiting. And we've got that, but I find with my wife, with the kids, unbelievable patience. I find that what I do with my temper clicks, but I've been patient 5, 10, 15, 21 times, and nobody ever realizes how well I've mastered that moment, being asked to be something I'm not. And then something small happens, and I don't know where it comes from, and I'm just like, that's enough on that. And then I look like an asshole, but I did it really well 21 times prior to now, maybe for 7 days with no sleep. But now I'm like, I can't do this shit anymore. I just want to walk. Like someone said to me the other day, you really must miss hanging out with Brona, you know, not being able to hang out with her. I said, mate, I just miss having a shit on my own, like without somebody banging on the door. Like he's got no kids. He doesn't understand. And like, it's madness. I want to have a shower without the kids going, can I get in with you? No, you can't. Go away. Like at some point I need to be on my own. But something we did learn that was quite good that may be helpful too is, yeah, we refuel differently. I come home and Brona hasn't spoken to anybody all day, so she wants to talk to me and I kind of need some downtime. We now, instead of having date night, we have date hour. So in the evening, she kind of gets a second wind, but I don't really, but I do a bit later. So we say, now, can we have let's have a date hour where we both go and do a job. What do we want to do? I could watch a movie or she could pot around or vice versa. And then we get together sort of from 9 till 10, then we do something together. So because if we don't almost deliberately schedule that connection, the other party can get offended and we're not trying to offend them. So by breaking the night into two, it's been quite good. So we have date hour or date half hour or date coffee, and we have these mini dates, which are really, we find them wonderful. They don't happen all the time, but even just having language for it helps.
Yeah, that is helpful. Yeah, we've on a Thursday, usually what Jesse and I do, we've got a 15-year-old kid who's homeschooled and just charges incredible rates to babysit kids, and she's an absolute superstar. Nahoa is her name. And yeah, she'll come around and take the boys for 5 hours. And Thursday afternoon, just because we struggle in the evening based on the fact that it's kids and then it's whatever, like we'll clean up the kitchen before you know it, it's 9 o'clock or I'm at comedy or whatever. So Thursday seems to be that little sweet spot, Thursday afternoon, where I go and we'll go down to a cafe and then we we usually end up at the library just putting in a couple of hours. She runs an online business herself and we'll go there, just enjoy some peace and quiet. But yeah, that's like another interesting conversation around just the structuring of your work from home. I find you touched on this earlier. I can't remember exactly what you said, but as you were speaking, I was just thinking about the, it was with regards to study. You're speaking about you'll come out energized. Your mum goes, oh, what the heck? Get back to your room, start studying. I've found that a little bit with working from home as well. A lot of my mindset is, all right, I've got to start at 9. I've got to finish at 5. That's the way you operate as a business owner. And I know for a fact that like whenever you've had a 9-to-5 job, very often you're not doing a 9-to-5 where you're working. You've got lunch breaks. You've got social interactions. You're doing whatever else it is that you're doing. But I've really struggled to let go of that mindset in regards to my work. Sometimes I'll do 2 hours of really solid work for the day and I'll look at what I wanted to achieve for the day and I go, oh, I'm actually, like if this was done purely on what I was trying to achieve today, I'm finished. But my mindset goes, no, Tosh, you've got 6 hours left to fill. And I find that wrestle between the time and efficiency struggle quite difficult. I'm really attracted to the idea of not working more for the sake of working more. I like the idea of getting what needs to be done, hopefully growing the business, and then moving on with whatever else it is you would like to do. And I know this is a really big topic in you know for the last 10 years or whatever, just time management and efficiency and probably whatever else it is you want to call it. But yeah, that's been a really interesting struggle working from home or working for myself more specifically is your it's possible to work 24/7 and still feel like you're not getting enough done. It's clearly like a mindset thing.
There's a few things at place there, and I'm more than happy to do a full show on it and dive into it because I know this space really well. If you were driving from, no, let's say you're riding a bike from Melbourne to Sydney, you would know the towns that you're going to stop at along the way, and you would ride, and you get to the town where you made it, and you would rest. Part of the problem is not knowing what a milestone is in your business, say each week or each month, and therefore you don't knock off. So we're using time as the target rather than some sort of number of podcasts set up or amount of dollars brought in or new leads created. So, and a lot of people don't know how to do that strategic planning, and you need to run it. You usually need some outside people sort of challenge you on that. I know that's why I have the business club where we meet every 2 months. Because often the work that happens in a business is often the things you've already got, you're obliged to do, business as usual. When you're a leader, you've got these other aspirations, but you're not accountable to anybody. So you can sometimes just keep putting them off to the side and they don't happen. So part of it is knowing what the milestone is so that once you've achieved that, then you can rest. From a human point of view, there's also a certain amount of work that somebody needs to have done in a day to feel satisfied, for that thirst to be quenched. Some people can have a little chocolate in nighttime. Some people need a whole block of chocolate. Some people can do a little bit of exercise to be satisfied. Some people need a big marathon. There's also, everyone has their own metric on how much work do I need to get done. And then there's the understanding of what's actually involved to get an outcome. In a work week, most of the week is not actually productive. And if it is a highly productive week, well, it's probably 1 week in 5 weeks that's productive.
Mm.
And what we need to value is the space between things. And I wasn't good at this, especially when I was having kids, because I always felt guilty, like I gotta get something done. But the creative process requires contemplation and meditation. And if you were out to go for a run, or you were to lay down and read a book or listen to a podcast and sit in the garden and just stare at a plant while you listen to a podcast, that's actually the work to make sure that the next thing is effective. So that's come back to that school model we taught. It's got to be hard. You got to apply yourself. But we're often doing things that are trying hard, not trying easy. And a mistake I made, and my coach helped me. I hired him as a counselor when mum passed, and he's been sensational for many things. He was able to point out that as a dad and as a provider, I've got this flexibility in my lifestyle. So therefore, if I see my family struggling, I tag in and help. And he said, you're building up this resentment though, because you can do it. But what you're not doing is it looks like easy, but it's less intense work that actually allows you to make the chess moves that I'm actually best. If I can lay in the park and stare at a tree, I'm actually contemplating what are my chess moves to be able to, you know, have the commercial success or whatever other success I want, or setting up meetings that are really enjoyable. Like I play tennis with Matt once every couple of months, and he's a celebrity chef, and we play tennis and we sort of talk about each other's work. And it looks like I'm playing tennis, but it's not. It's just the way the meeting is played out. And so I tend to call this process, I call it my university lifestyle, that I've got things I need to do, but I can do them when I want to do them. And so now it's all on me. Can I manage that? Or do I need to go back into a school structure, which is just tells me what to do and when? And I would add to that, the last thing I would add to it is I do find I need a different place for each activity. So before, when you said that you do a whole lot of online yoga, I thought that was really interesting, because if I was doing online yoga, I would need a space in my house allocated to only yoga. If it was a workspace and a yoga space, I couldn't handle that. That my brain would not. I need a different location. And I think that's another part of this whole process, is that when you finish working really hard, you probably need a different geography to do the next thing. And that's something that I've learned through all the
– That's a good point. Yeah, I've actually noticed that, because quite often, like right now, I'm on a little studio at the back of the house, but this doubles as a man cave, as a yoga studio, as a whatever. And I often notice if I've been in here for a couple of hours doing work, and then it's like, all right, it's exercise time today, I'll do yoga or Pilates, both online. Yeah, I don't necessarily enjoy it, but I've always just been like, oh, what's that? You just want to get out of the room. Yeah, it's interesting to note that. Yeah, there's often, I probably do that subconsciously. Like, quite often go down to a cafe when I've got boring admin jobs, because I like the background hum. I like a little bit of social atmosphere. I like a good coffee, get out of the house, break things up. It just feels like a little bit of a reset button.
But it's actually a different geography, and you think you like all those things, but you could also do it without those things if you're in a different place. You could, like you said, you go to the library, and it's not to say that that's not a great place to do it. Like, it's sensational, the cafe, the coffee and the social, it's all good, because you can do those admin tasks because it's not deep work. When I go to a cafe and do deep work, I'll have to put my headphones in often so people don't speak to me. And even when they do speak to me, I don't even hear them. I come across rude, but it's not. I'm just so deeply concentrating on something. Usually my face says it, like, don't talk to me, but I've gone to a cafe. What an idiot. But the reason I'm at a cafe is because there's not another space that's allocated. And what I also find, not for all personalities, but for mine and quite a lot of the artists I've advised, if I've written a book on this computer, I cannot write a second book on this computer. So it's like if you go on a first date at a restaurant and you break up with that person, you can't go on a first date to that restaurant with someone else, because that place has already got a memory. So as my business evolves, I often need a new canvas, whether it be a new computer, a new chair, a new desk, a new space. And people often just don't understand that. They rationalize it, but it's just not actually quite true. It's actually the geography or a resource needs to match the activity. And once you start to embrace that, you really can increase your potency. But it is difficult at home, because as soon as you're resting and you see your family struggling, you think, it's not fair for me to be enjoying this process. I should struggle too.
Yeah, it's so true. Is that part of the reason you I don't know how long you've had the office in Docklands for, but it must be nice driving in there each morning and just knowing that you've got like some dedicated space to do what you want to do and be fully there, rather than hearing kids yelling and screaming in the background and trying to navigate that world as well.
It is good, except it's run its course in that it was a new canvas, like a new computer, and I've achieved a whole lot here. Now my business is moving, and when I come here, it feels old and stagnant now. And so I've just recently built a loft in the house. So we had a high roof, and I enjoyed those projects, but it actually gave us a new room because the kids are growing and we needed a playroom. So I've often been using the loft, which has been really fun. But I can hear the kids screaming, unfortunately, at that point. But there's some days when it's super practical. But I'm really aware that at the moment I'm actually not coming into this office enough to justify its expense. Although it's not very expensive. I'm in Docklands. It's only $1,000 a month. It's not a lot of money. Yeah. But it does get used. There's people coming in here today. There's people coming in here quite a lot. But I'm just wondering what's next so it feels fresh again. And because logically you could say, oh, you've got a great office, just use that space. Why don't you use that? But logic is not how human motive works. There's this art form. And when you're an outlier, and that doesn't mean you're the better than anyone, but when you're just doing something that's a little unconventional, you have a different model. And you would fit into that category too. So, for example, if you built a small deck on the back porch that had a heater, you'd probably start to enjoy doing yoga on the back porch with a heater. And that would be the yoga space, right? And people can't, if you're not watching, if you listen to this on audio, you just lit up then when I said the Tyson. Like, his face says, yeah, I'd like that. You know, that's what the brain wants, that. It needs a specific space for different activities.
Yeah, that's interesting, man. That's cool. Well, the loft sounds like it's a cool next step. It sounds like you've invested more years in handyman activities than me, because the idea of building a loft, I'd be like that chick with the white picket fence. I feel like I'd be doing a lot of research, and then truth is I'd be waiting until my brother-in-law came back to Australia to hopefully build it for me.
That's right, mate. It's true. I do like it. It's my passion. It's been very difficult to not have enough time to build things. But I could build a whole house now for sure and far essentially out. Have done.
That's wild. Yeah, that'd be a wild endeavor. Yeah. Dobbo, it's always too long between drinks, but I appreciate you coming on. I know we had some kind of idea of what we were going to talk about. I don't think we even touched
on it. Didn't even scratch it. Maybe. I'm glad, because we both texted each other and prepped for this and said, oh, that was our list. Should we just wing it? Yeah, let's just wing it.
Well, I always know there's some people that I've spoken to enough to go, oh, if I sat down for a coffee with this person for an hour and a half, would I need to take notes? And the answer was not at all. And so I'm sort of glad, because they're my favorite podcast to do. So I was glad you're on the same page as me. But, man, always great to have you on. Thanks so much for making the time again.
Mate, I really enjoy it. It's a good chat. And, yeah, it's nice to always be connected to a community of people that are on a similar wavelength, which is, uncharted to uncommon conversations.
For sure.
Beautiful, mate.
For sure. All right, Dobbo. Thanks a lot. We'll see you later. See everybody.